name is Paul Greatrix, and my guest on this episode of My Imaginary University is Alistair Jarvis, Pro Vice Chancellor, Partnerships and Governance at the University of London. Generously supported by a billionaire philanthropist, Alistair's university is based on three campuses, on estates by the sea on the south coast of England, in Dubai and in Nigeria. The three campuses are equal in every way, and every student is mobile, studies other languages, and all fees are paid. The university's campuses are really a special feature. They all have nice beaches and are open, integrated into their communities, and offer great food as well as work and compulsory volunteering opportunities. In educating future socially conscious global leaders, the university has a strong access mission, recruits worldwide on the basis of potential, and has also just decided to launch into the online realm. However, it remains without a name or indeed an anthem, so is running competitions to come up with what will hopefully be sensible suggestions for both. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome everyone to the latest edition of My Imaginary University, and this time it is my enormous pleasure to introduce Alistair Jarvis, who is Pro Vice-Chancellor, Partnerships and Governance at the University of London. Alistair was previously for a long period Chief Executive at Universities UK and had a long and illustrious history in the sector before that. So welcome, Alistair. It's great to have you with us today, and I'm really excited to hear what you're going to create. But before we kick off, let me just say that I've got no idea what you're going to tell me. You've been, mulling over your ideas for some time, and it's going to be as exciting for me to learn about your imaginary university as anyone else. So, without further ado, let me ask you to paint the picture, to give us the overview of your institution, please, Alistair.
Paul, it's a real pleasure to join you, and I'm a fan of the podcast. And the moment you asked me, I said yes. But also, when you start thinking about it, your mind runs wild, and the creative ideas you come up with. But I will try and keep some broad focus to what I say. I'm going to start off by saying that my imaginary university has started from a very fortunate position. A billionaire philanthropist, very liberally minded, very socially conscious. Later in his life, he had made billions and billions from business. And later in his life, he decided he wanted to give back to the world. And he was a real global citizen. And therefore, he gave some startup funding to establish a new university. But perhaps most importantly of all, he gave the university three estates. Now, this man was very much a global citizen, and he had three wonderful grand houses, beautiful grounds, all by the sea, interestingly, huge greenfield campuses. One was on the south coast of England, the second was on the coast in Dubai, and the third was on the coast in Nigeria. And he decided to gift these three wonderful campuses, buildings, lovely old houses, to be the three campuses of a new university. And in the last 10 years of his life, he invested a lot of his own time and effort in establishing this new university. And sadly, last year he died when the university was just gone past its 10th birthday. And he has now set up as a legacy an endowment that will fund the universities in perpetuity in the future, and his whole estate goes into that. So that's the sort of starting point.
You're flush, in other words.
Yeah, flush, but flush through with a real vision, a real solidity to this big endowment, and so the university will be run on the endowment income. But the estate's already there. He spent the last 10 years developing these three wonderful, almost old-fashioned estates into wonderful modern campuses.
So, okay, right. So it's a really good starting point, right? So that's a really good place to be. So tell us a bit then about the character of the organisation then. So I get they've got, these great estates, a great physical
positioning in three countries. How does that manifest itself in practice in terms of, you know, the scale and reach and specialisms and activities of this great international university?
Well, the sort of founding father, the sadly deceased philanthropist, he had a very strong sort of moral guiding compass. And this is very embedded in how the university works. So the first is he was a true internationalist. And therefore, the three campuses are in every way equal. And what I mean by that is they're equal in size, they're equal in student numbers. They receive the same amount of funding per year from the endowment. They have the same subject mix. They have the same student staff ratio. However, they have their own unique cultural feel. And being a student at this university, there are 18,000 students at the university, 6,000 on each of the campuses, of which 4,000 study on the sort of core degree program. So that's an undergraduate degree, but with a master's year embedded. So it's a 4-year degree. Then they've got 1,000 PhD students and 1,000 foundation year students on each campus. And the numbers are very strictly regulated. So it's monitored. The deal is that it's 6,000, 6,000, 6,000 in those ratios. Now, of course, this means that the core is the 4-year degree, and a 4-year degree, including an MA year. But uniquely, and the thing that I think is just sort of super attractive to students and creates a real, really interesting experience, is all of the degrees are 2+1+1. So every student spends 2 years on one campus, 1 year on a second campus, and 1 year on a third campus. The other aspect to this is there are no fees paid. So the admissions, there's a very strict admissions policy. I say strict, but unspecific. The strict admissions policy is that they recruit on potential. So it's not on academic record, it is on potential. Every applicant is interviewed, and there are global outreach teams that go across the world searching for students who would benefit, potential students who would benefit from this kind of educational experience. They are tasked to ensure that they consider socioeconomic diversity, because this university absolutely wants to be an elite university, but not elitist.
So I've heard that phrase before.
Well, indeed, yeah, I may have stolen that from another university. But the in the core here is about providing a really high quality education experience to the globe. But it's not people who have necessarily had lots of privilege before. It's not people who have got wonderful prior attainment. It's people who would benefit from this wonderful global educational experience. But then there's other sort of key features. So I've talked about these sort of wonderful green campuses. These have got beautiful grounds. They're by the sea. Each campus has its own beach, because these are rolling estates going down to the beach. And interestingly, all three of them, because he was a kind of global citizen and quite sort of connected with the world, each of them is actually on the edge of a large town as well. So it's a greenfield sort of site on the edge of a large town. And there are these wonderful old buildings that he has spent in his later life converting into wonderful university buildings. But despite what sounds like a sort of lovely, maybe slightly isolated campus kind of environment, they are highly embedded within their local communities, and they are highly embedded with sort of local business as well. And the student experience has kind of four pillars to it. So it's highly international. As I said, 2 years, 1 year, 1 year.
Yeah.
And also every student has to learn, it's all taught in English. The English is the language teaching, but all students have to learn Arabic and French. So Arabic in Dubai, and French is the second language, as you'll know, in Nigeria. English is the first language, but French is spoken as a second language. Now, it's not credit bearing. The language part is not credit bearing, but all students are expected to take language courses. So to be able to engage with a wider diversity of people. So big pillars, there's international, there's culture and sport. So a great believer in the roundness of the student experience. Really community focused and really enterprise business focused, but enterprise business focused with a social purpose.
I'm loving this, right? But I'm uh, and I'm thinking just how good it is to have loads of money to enable these things to happen. I absolutely get the nature of the experience that the generous benefactor has sought to establish as part of this. And it's idyllic, right? I mean, it sounds like the very, you know, kind of, you know, absolutely, you know, platonic ideal of a university with all those elements you mentioned. Can I just go back to the selection thing, right? Because I think that's really, really important, right? The aim to get real diversity based on potential. I suppose, how in practice does that work? Essentially, does the net get cast very wide and you say, come all ye who want to study here and we'll interview you? I mean, is it as broad as that, and then sending missions out to, you know, to Nepal and Canada and wherever to find people and say, we're in town, guys, come and have an interview? Is that the kind of way it works?
It's absolutely both. So there is an open application process, so anyone can apply, and right. There is a open access in that way, but absolutely there are teams that go across the world to try and identify people who would benefit for this kind of educational experience, and that then links into, you know, they're looking for people who want to have a social impact, care about communities, and have the potential to go on and be leaders in that way, but with a really keen eye on making sure that they're socially and culturally diverse. And in fact, the experience they get will help grow that sort of social cultural diversity in the people that the university educates. It's probably worth saying that the sort of education itself. So every student does this 2 year, 1 year, 1 year.
Yeah.
I'll come on to the PhD and foundation years in a moment, because there's a point of having them as well. But 2 year, 1 year, 1 year. Everyone does a work placement.
Right.
And everybody volunteers. And I mentioned everyone does
compulsory volunteering.
Some language. Yes, compulsory volunteering. Yes. But the reason why this is possible, why the work placements, the volunteering is so possible, is the feel of the campuses. So much as I talked about wonderful old buildings and green campuses, these all three campuses are really like small towns. So local community groups are invited on to the campus. There's independent theatre, there's art galleries, there's sculptures, local sports teams, including some professional sports teams, located on the campus. The local mayors have offices on the campus. Chambers of Commerce, business chambers of commerce have that. All of the commercial services, catering and things like that, accommodation, are all run by local social enterprises. So you've got a real sort of town. You've got nurseries and schools on the campuses. And of course, with all of these things, you know, sports facilities, cultural facilities, community groups, it provides a huge amount of options for work placements, for volunteering. And so it's really quite natural that the students become embedded in the local community.
For the period that they're there, I mean, that I imagine is quite challenging when they then move to the other and they've got to kind of start again. But I bet there will be enough glue from those that are there at the time, I guess, to help with manage their integration into that new society.
There will, and also every student is paired with students studying at the other two campuses.
Aha! Oh, so it's like a kind of academic parent, like you get in some universities, that kind of model.
That's right. So when you start your course, whichever three campuses you start at, and typically you'll do. You said it's 2-1-1. So whichever campus you start on, you will be paired with somebody on both of the other campuses. So you have that little network across the three, which helps encourage the cultural diversity. It helps encourage the international outlook. And also, actually, in a soft way, it helps ensure that the experience is comparative across the three campuses. So, you know, he was very, very clear that when he gave this legacy to the endowment, that there was not a lead campus, that the three are equal in every way.
Yeah. Well, we'll come on to governance in a minute. I'm fascinated to hear how it actually worked. But let me just stick with the, you know, the undergraduate experience. And so I think you've set that out very well in terms of the you know, what the feel of campus life actually is and what students are doing outside the classroom. But let me come back inside the classroom. They're doing languages, they're doing placements, they're doing volunteering. In terms of curriculum then, you say it's the same on all campuses. So are we offering a full range of typical degree courses or a narrow range? Are they multidisciplinary? What's the offer?
So there is breadth, but breadth only in arts, humanities and social sciences. So there is no science and no engineering. So if you're a student that wants to do that, this isn't the university for you. It is arts, humanities and social sciences. Part of the reason for that is the university wanted to specialise. They wanted to have a sort of specialism. But also actually there's a cost reason here as well, that although he had very deep pockets and has left a lot of money, he hadn't built the facilities for big science, engineering, etc. So it's arts, humanities, social sciences. However, it is unashamedly vocational. And what I mean by that is that every degree has placements built in. Every student volunteers in something with a sort of social purpose, social impact. And they're expected to develop skills and attributes which will help them in their future career. Now, that doesn't mean it's necessarily particularly money focused, but it's about creating sort of employability skills through the curriculum. So it's arts, humanities, social sciences, but with that strong sort of vocational steer. So each year of your course, you do a work placement, and throughout your 4 years, you volunteer. The other interesting thing, which is why we have the PhD students to some degree, is all the education is research informed. So all students do get involved with research projects. Now, some of those research projects will be ones that the professoriate or the PhD students are working on, but others will be more applied in local businesses, local charities, local social enterprises, the local cultural and sports teams. So, you know, the students can go and learn about business problems at the professional sports club. They can go and learn about a challenge that the local theatre or cinema is having. They will have, so it is research-informed, research-engaged teaching, and that research is really important. So it's vocational, it's research-focused, arts, humanities, social sciences.
Right. Okay. That's really interesting. And yeah, I can see how that works in the context of this institution. Tell me a bit then about how things operate. Right. So if no campus is dominant, they're all equal. Have they all got their own vice chancellor? Is there one boss who spends their entire week travelling? So I assume you're the founding vice chancellor, Alistair. So, I mean, how do you manage the whole operation?
So no, I'm not the founding vice chancellor. I have just been asked by when the billionaire philanthropist was sort of later in life, he wanted somebody to ensure that the foundations for the university were put in place, and that the transfer from when he sadly died over to the university being funded by the legacy is embedded within the spirit and the direction he wanted. So I played a sort of loose coordination role just to help ensure that his sort of the spirit of what he wanted to achieve continues. But I have no executive sort of responsibilities. But so the way it works is that we decided not to use the sort of vice chancellor title or the president title or anything like that, because it sounds sort of incredibly hierarchical, like there's the one person in charge. But there are three provosts, one running each of the three campuses. The big decisions are made by that triumvirate. And it is their job to work together to do that. Now, to ensure that no one of the three campuses arises as a sort of lead campus, I mentioned that the income each year is the same for each three, the scale of them is the same, and the degree programs, so they're going to launch new degree programs, going to move into new areas, they have to agree as the three of them will do that, and they need to employ the staff and facilities to do that. So it is very much collective across the three. Importantly, though, are the contracts the provosts are on. So what was quite interesting is in the early years, things were not quite as equal. As you were setting it up, it was a little bit kind of chaotic. But what we've now embedded down, you know, we are now just over 10 years into this university. Each of the provosts is on a 12-year contract. And they do 4 years at each leading each campus.
Ah.
But what's really nice is now it's embedded, we've staggered them. So there is one who is now 8 years in, there's one who's 4 years in, and there's one who's just started. So every 4 years, the sort of you move around, one of them rolls off having completed the 12 years, and somebody new comes in. And the sort of qualities we're looking for in leadership are people with a very strong social conscience, but people who have a sort of global outlook and would see as a, you know, as a lifestyle choice, living and working in three different countries over a 12-year sort of leadership period would be attractive.
Wow, that is really, really interesting as a model. And I can see how it works, despite the fact, obviously, you know, historically, triumvirates have always had, you know, a slightly ropey background. But actually, that works quite well. OK, let me pursue a slightly different angle. And in terms of supervision and oversight of this, is there some kind of governing body overseeing all three campuses and ensuring, you know, that those things that you've introduced and ensuring the philanthropist's legacy wishes are actually being sustained? Is there a kind of governing body?
Yes, there is. There is one right. Single governing body.
Right. OK.
There are not three. The governing body is not split down in three ways. It is one single governing body. All three university leaderships will have a role in helping attract people with the right sort of mindset and values and experience to sit on that governing body. But it is one single governing body.
Right. OK. And in terms of, you know, the ambitions for the university, I mean, I assume, you know, league table positions don't really feature because the compilers can't actually work out what to do with you. But in terms of where the university ends up, I mean, it's still very, very young, right?
It is, yeah.
But has actually clearly embedded itself very quickly and got an international profile. But where will it end up? Where does it see itself looking like in 50 years' time? Will it be the preeminent university in each of those three countries? What's the ambition?
So it sees itself more as a global university than it does a university of any of those three countries.
Right.
And it is absolutely meant to be an elite university for social sciences, humanities and arts to develop socially conscious global leaders. But right embedded in the core is that community impact and is access. And this is where the foundation years come in. And I mentioned to you that 4,000 students do a BAMA combined, effectively a 4-year sort of degree, 2+1+1. But there's 1,000 foundation year students in each campus and 1,000 PhD students on campus. That's how you get your 666 and 18,000 students overall. And this is right to the core of this sort of access mission. So as the global recruitment teams go out and identify people with the potential to benefit from this kind of education, there is some space there for people who are not quite ready to go into a degree programme to come in and do the foundation year. And the aim is that 100% of people who do the foundation year then move into do the thing. So it is very much seen as a feeder to the main degree. What's it want to be in the future? It wants to be a university that is developing people that have a hugely positive, socially conscious global impact. And through the educational experience, through the time they've done volunteering, through the international ethos, from the cultural experiences, diverse cultural experiences they get, you create socially conscious, community-minded global citizens who can then go out and do good in the world. So that's the ethos. Now, there's one thing I haven't mentioned, and the demand for this university is already huge. I mean, there's so many people that want to go in, and the quality is very, very clear to see.
And it's free.
Sorry, and it's free. Yeah, and it's free. And the university sort of thought long and hard about its scale, and the endowment cannot stretch to an infinite expansion. Nor do the campuses themselves, which are absolutely core to the experience. And I haven't even talked about the food. The food is very important. There are beautiful grounds. There are catered halls. There is local catering colleges who are sort of running the food. And it has that lot of local influences, locally sourced food. So beautiful gardens rolling down to the sea. You know, this kind of feel.
Oh yeah.
With a community and the students into sort of playing with each other. This all adds to the educational experience and the student experience. So if you expanded massively, you would probably ruin what's sort of a really special model.
Yeah.
But the university is also kind of desperate to have a greater impact than its 18,000. So it has just decided on a really exciting new development. And it's going to double the numbers by having... Well, almost double. It's going to have 15,000 online students.
Right.
And that's going to be 12,000 UGM BAMA students again. So exactly to match the 12,000 online. And another 3,000 foundation program students. So 15,000. It's not going to do 1,000. It's not going to do 3,000 the PhD again. It's decided to stick at that. And again, it's going to be free, but the numbers are limited to that. So we don't want to overstretch. We don't want to get to a position where we don't have the money to guarantee you the quality of the experience. Same admissions policy. Free. You're interviewed. It's on potential. Looking at a diversity socially, culturally of an intake. But again, you're paired. You're paired with an on-campus student. So every student online is paired with an on-campus student. The degree content is the same. It's obviously presented in a way that is accessible online,
yeah.
But it's the, you know, it's the same people marking your exams. It's the same professoriate that's creating the intellectual content of the degrees. And, you know, clearly it's a modern VLE platform. And there's a summer school attached to it as well. So over your 4 years of your online degree, you'll get invited to spend a bit of time at each of the campuses. Right. So summer school format. So this is a really exciting new development. Suddenly we are, you know, our very capped 18,000, we've suddenly got another 15,000 learners who are bringing in. So here's a new venture that we're just setting up, but we're just working out how to do this.
Okay. And that is really, really interesting. And I can see when you've got the model that you've got that can work. And also, again, having the money to invest in it to ensure that the experience for those students, plus the shorter on-campus experience they get, will mean it's a meaningful learning experience for them. Are there any regulatory issues in relation to any of this, or do you exist happily outside the regulatory tentacles in each of those three countries? I'm sure there must be something you've got to do, isn't it?
Yeah, so we are registered with the regulators in the three countries, and we are formally registered university, because we're not charging fees. You know, for example, in the UK, the regulation is slightly softer than it would be if we were sort of higher fee charging. But you know, sadly in the UK, you know, we do have to meet the conditions of registration, because we are a proper university. But we see ourselves as a global university. So I would say that we are cognizant and lean in positively to the regulatory environment in each country, but we do not feel overly burdened by that, because we are operating at a global level, not at a national level.
And you mentioned that the generous benefactor who founded the university was, I think you said he was a bit of a moralist, right? Does that manifest itself in any way in terms of the ethos on the campus? So I'm thinking, is it at the you know, the kind of extreme end of some US universities where you know things like denim and beards are banned, you know, that kind of thing, or is it slightly more liberal than that?
He was incredibly sort of socially liberal, he was somebody who made a lot of money through his business interests, but wanted their he believed in businesses doing social good within communities, but globally. And therefore, his causes are sort of small L liberal, socially liberal sort of causes. And so wanted a better educated world, socially conscious, environmentally conscious, community orientated people. But he was very liberally minded. And actually, you know, the campuses, and I hope I've sort of emphasized from the cultural attractions, the sporting attractions, the fact that the beach on the campuses, they're beautiful green. He wanted them to be places where people would learn through the people they met and the experiences they had as much as the academic content. So there's no real sort of, I suppose, the moral morally conscious, I suppose, or socially conscious, but there isn't a sort of a heavy-handed moral compass in that way.
Excellent. And you know, all the stuff you talked about in terms of the kind of integration and the cross-campus support for each other and the way in which people pair with other people, I mean, all of that sounds enormously positive, both from the point of view of developing that rounded graduate and that graduate with a very international outlook, as well as diverse language skills. But I suppose the other element of it, presumably, is that A, withdrawal rates are extremely low because actually, you know, people feel a very powerful sense of belonging and commitment to the organization and wanting to complete a degree. But also, presumably, they're incredibly employable.
Indeed, they are. And I mean, they are both employable, but also hopefully entrepreneurial. So I mentioned that there's a lot of social enterprises on campus. There are businesses located on campus, you know, strong relationships with chambers of commerce, with, you know, professional sports and cultural organizations as well. And a business mind is sort of something which we hope to develop in our students. A business mind, but with a social conscience, I think, is that sort of thing. So absolutely highly employable, you know, across sort of globally minded sort of organizations across the world. But also we hope people will go and set up charities and social enterprises and other things as well. I should sort of add that although there is a generous endowment that is funding this each year, you know, our hope would be in the long term that some students would also, alumni would give back, which will sort of keep the endowment topped up as well, actually. Because, you know, it is absolutely the case that you know, written into the statutes is that we don't charge, you know, we don't charge to come here. Yeah. And thankfully, there is enough in the endowment to provide a good income stream from the investment returns to the three campuses. But our hope would be that these are people who would want to themselves give back in the long term.
Yeah. Great. We've talked in very broad ways about many of the different dimensions of, you know, what is a very distinctive university offer across three nations. Are there any other particular features, any other, you know, distinctive dimensions of this very successful but yet very young university that we've not mentioned that you wanted to touch on?
Well, just an interesting feature, which I think sort of adds to the feeling of equality amongst the three campuses and no sort of lead campus, is the south coast of England, the coast of Nigeria, and the coast of Dubai. They're actually 8-hour flights apart. So traveling between any of the two campuses takes you almost exactly 8 hours. So it's not as if there is sort of one a long way away and two close together. They are equidistant from each other in all ways.
Well, that makes it all perfect in terms of the tri-campus operation, although the time difference inevitably creates complexities around committee meetings. But, you know, that's life, isn't it?
I think that's a small price to pay.
So, Alistair, are there any other distinctive features of the university and its three-campus operation that we need to cover that we've not mentioned yet?
There's a problem that I wonder actually whether the listeners to the podcast might be able to help solve as well. So the problem is the sort of founding billionaire philanthropist, he was called Mr. Smith, and so not the most exciting sort of name in the world. And he never named the university.
Ah.
And he certainly decided he didn't want it to be Smith University. And he never named it. And so as part of the legacy pledge, so after it had been running about 10 years, and he then made the big legacy gift that then created the endowment, he asked that a naming competition was established. And so we're currently on the search for a name for this university. So, you know, suggestions would be really welcome.
Well, the last thing you should do is run a naming competition in Britain at the moment, because of the, you know, the inevitable humorous suggestions you will get. But nevertheless, we will open it up, Alistair, and see what people come up with. I'll be very interested to see if there are any creative suggestions. So how interesting.
Thank you.
And presumably there will be a filter, and you know, the governing body ultimately will decide. Yes. So you won't get anything too silly. So the critical final question then, and this may have been something that your generous benefactor left in his will. What's the anthem? So what's the piece of music that you forever associate with this as yet unnamed international high quality young institution?
Sadly, that is also subject to disagreement and debate. There is some tension between the three provosts at the moment, and indeed the university communities, about something which has that proper global significance. So at the moment we are sadly university songless. However, there is a real commitment by the governing body that when we name the university, we will also announce a university song. But it is a real it's a real gap. And actually that is a sort of gap that is felt amongst the university community. But unfortunately, as of yet, we haven't managed to find that anthem which really brings people together. Which is a shame, because the university in so many ways, you know, is sort of beautifully intertwined. But it's we've really struggled to find the song that brings people together.
Well, I can imagine. And again, there's you know, the kind of thing that spans three nations is or indeed, you know, the world is quite difficult to do. But and also you don't want to select something which is too ephemeral and too parochial to one location. So I can see the challenge. So presumably we'll go hand in hand then with the name.
It is very much the intention that when the university is named, there will also be the confirmation of the university song. But sadly, the anthem as yet there isn't a decision on that.
So, but if it ends up being Taylor Swift University, the choices are obvious. But I should say Taylor Swift is currently the best represented artiste in terms of university songs that I'm aware of from imaginary universities that have been created in recent years. Alistair, we need to stop there. But listen, that's been extraordinarily entertaining. And what a great vision for a great tri-campus global university with a really distinctive and interesting mission. So it's been a huge pleasure to talk to you.
Paul, thanks so much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed doing it, and you know, keep up the good work with the podcast. It's always a great listen, so thank you.
And we will share the answers of the naming in due course.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to hearing the ideas.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that episode of My Imaginary University. There'll be more along before you know it. In the meantime, you might want to listen to the sister podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I chat to university leaders and registrars and others like that, all about their experiences of higher education. Just Google it. Also, you may want to visit my website, wonderfulhighered.com. where you can find lots of entertaining stuff all about the strange, wonderful and frightening world of higher education. Anyway, until the next time, thank you for listening.